I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. A month ago, we learned that Wells Fargo had fired more than 5,000 employees for secretly opening 2 million accounts, unbeknownst to customers who were on the hook for fees, putting their credit rating at risk. The bank that has almost $2 trillion in assets paid a $185 million penalty. But that did not mollify Congress. Last week, CEO John Stumpf faced a barrage of criticism from the House Financial Services Committee.
You and your entire leadership team are clearly and unequivocally guilty of at least conspiracy to commit fraud, conspiracy to commit identity theft, clearly racketeering, which is something a lot of my friends know something about, and probably a dozen other crimes.
And Mr. Stumpf, I regrettably have a mortgage with your bank. I wish I didn't. If I was in the position to pay it off, I would, because you have broken my trust and you have broken the trust of millions of others, and it will be a long, long time to earn that trust back.
What standards are you holding yourself to that sends the message to the rest of these folks in your organization that look to you for leadership and guidance? What are you doing to restore that?
So you came here and you started out by saying, I apologize, etc. If somebody walked into Wells Fargo tomorrow and robbed your bank or defrauded your bank, and then after they're caught, they'll say, well, I'm sorry. I'm going to take full responsibility for robbing this bank, and I am sorry that I robbed this bank. So please don't prosecute me because I am sorry now that I robbed this bank. Would you allow the person just to walk out after robbing your bank because he is now sorry that he robbed his bank after he took the money already?
Ooh. The week before, Senator Elizabeth Warren didn't mince words as she dressed down Stumpf at a Senate Banking Committee hearing.
So you haven't resigned. You haven't returned a single nickel of your personal earnings. You haven't fired a single senior executive. Instead, evidently, your definition of accountable is to push the blame to your low-level employees who don't have the money for a fancy PR firm to defend themselves. It's gutless leadership.
Workers at the bank have described a pressure cooker environment to open multiple accounts for each customer, as many as 8, according to Senator Warren. Well, today in Radio Times, how did this happen? What does it say about Wells Fargo and the banking industry? Joining us is Michael Corkery, reporter for The New York Times, who covers finance and banking, has been covering this story. And Michael, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us and here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Lynn Anderson, Associate Professor of Human Resources Management at the Fox School of Business at Temple University. And Lynn, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much.
You know, Michael, listening to that montage that we put together, did this scandal at Wells Fargo at least temporarily unite Congress against the CEO?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, it doesn't seem like Congress and anybody in Washington can agree on anything these days, but apparently Wells Fargo is the exception. I mean, from both sides of the aisle, first in the Senate and then last week in the House, John Stumpf, the CEO, was just excoriated for what happened at the bank over a five-year period, and then also the bank's response to this scandal. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. I mean, you know, there's been banking scandals, you know, since the financial crisis and certainly the financial crisis itself. But I don't think we've seen such across the board sort of condemnation from Congress of a banking executive like we saw and like we're seeing of Wells Fargo.
What I heard from Elizabeth Warren and some others was that if you didn't know, you're still responsible. And if you did know, you're obviously responsible, too.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's any good defense that John Stumpf has been able to offer up to Congress about how this went down. And I think, you know, after the first hearing before the Senate, when he came in and was just offering a simple apology and saying he took responsibility, but Elizabeth Warren, you know, I think really set the stage and, you know, asking, well, what have you done to hold yourself accountable? I mean, you've held 5,300, you know, lower level employees making $12 an hour accountable. That's fine. You fired them. But what about you? What about your executives? Have you given any money back? And the answer he had was no. Then ahead of the hearing last week, he did give some money back, or his board, the Wells Fargo board of directors, made him give money back $41 million of stock. He had that was clawed back. The former head of the community bank, Carrie Tolstead, who was basically overseeing all of this, she's no longer at the bank. She was allowed to quietly retire over the summer. She also had $19 million clawed back. A lot of people saw that move, those clawbacks, as trying to satiate the Congress. Congressional committee, it didn't seem to work because they only seemed angrier than the senators the week before.
What do you make of this, Lynn Anderson?
There are just so many rich ways to slice it. I mean, there's so many things that seemingly Wells Fargo is not doing correctly. Like, where was the board in all this? You know, John Stumpf, as is common at many of these companies, served as both chair of the board and as CEO, which, you know, many board corporate governance experts say is not a good thing. It's a little too incestuous. Wells Fargo, interestingly, has been lauded for its very diverse board in terms of women, minorities on the board and everything. But also, it appears that they were an inactive board. They weren't calling Stumpf out, and they were letting incentive system, you know, permeate down the line that was obviously a caustic incentive system. So there's one slice. Also at the strategic level, you could say that, you know, despite the fact that Wells Fargo espouses a stakeholder model, like a stakeholder view of themselves as dealing with all their stakeholders and being the community bank, they obviously were misprioritizing their stakeholders. They were, you know, prioritizing the owner stakeholders, the shareholders, somewhat at the expense of employees and customers. But even the shareholders are not going to be happy with this outcome because they're going to ultimately be the ones ending up paying the fines.
Well, it's always kind of fun quoting Senator Warren because – and she certainly was – pointed and direct in her criticism. You mentioned the board, and she said to Stumpf, "You keep saying the board. You describe them like they're strangers you met in a dark alley. Mr. Stumpf, you are chairman of the board."
Right. I loved that. I'm so glad she called him out on it. It was great.
Michael, let me go back to you, and let's go back to the beginning. We're talking about something called cross-selling. We're talking about people going to Wells Fargo, to open a checking account. Take us back to the beginning and what was transpiring.
Sure. So cross-selling is the buzzword in banking, retail banking. It's, you know, you get somebody, a customer, they come in, they have a checking account. Okay, well, then you give them a savings account. And while they're there, try to sell them a mortgage or an auto loan or, you know, a wealth management account. That's, you know, all the banks do it. You know, I think in this economy, after, you know, the recession, if you had a good customer with some, you know, decent financial prospects, once you got them, you want to sell them everything. Again, that's it's standard practice in the banking industry. But what Wells Fargo was doing was they were creating for their employees these unbelievably high goals for cross-selling.
Eight is great.
Right. I mean, if you think about that, and I think as some of these senators have, or some of the congresspeople have raised it, it's like eight accounts. How many possible accounts can you have from a bank? Eight seems like a lot. But that was it. They said they could do it. That was their goal. So a lot of these employees, you know, faced with this unbelievably arduous goal, were, it turned out, faking it. And they were saying they were signing up all these folks for different accounts. But what they were doing was basically creating phony accounts, phony emails, phony, using PIN numbers, creating PIN numbers. Often they would open the account and then close it 2 days later. So this is like a checking account, in some cases a credit card. And then they would get credit for that goal, for hitting that sales goal. In some cases, they didn't close it, and that's when people ran into trouble, the customers, because they would say, "Hey, wait, what's this fee? I didn't even know I had this account. What a credit card? And I'm late on the credit card. What's going on here?" So that went on for 5 years at the bank, and like some scandals, the CEO doesn't know about them, and then it finally, you know, bubbles up to his attention and something is done about it. In this case, John Stumpf knew, he said, that this scandal was going on as early as 2013. And he also admitted, or the bank has admitted, that they were still firing people as of March of this year for making these phony accounts. I mean, that's 3 full years of this thing going on day in, day out. And I think that's when Congress and the committees really bore into Mr. Stumpf. It's about where was the leadership? I mean, it's one thing for something to go wrong at your bank. Once you find out about it, it's on you to really do something about it. And it doesn't seem like he did.
Lynn, let me go back to you. And my understanding, as Michael just told us, this came to light a couple of years ago, about 3 years ago. And apparently the bank did increase monitoring and ethics training, but clearly this was still going on. So what does that tell you? And it's hard to imagine that what low-level bank employees came up with this idea all by themselves to create something like 2 million phony fake accounts.
Well, it's interesting. As Michael said, it's been going on a couple years, and now they've even been able to trace back the practices back to even 2009. And, Stumpf mentioned he knew since 2013, and that was when the L.A. Times investigation began. But obviously it's been going on longer. It's deeper than that. And what's interesting about it is, that Wells Fargo's espoused vision, it reads like this. We want to satisfy our customers' financial needs and help them succeed financially. Okay, that's great. That's wonderful. That's what banks should be doing, right? That's what bankers are for, connecting lenders and borrowers and, satisfying customers. But the incentive system, the cross-selling incentive system, of course, didn't match that at all. I mean, it did not match that vision. And that is very, very common in large corporations, that there'll be, an espoused ethical system, that you'll have ethics training, but that no incentives are in place to actually enact that ethics system. And there's no incentives at all to behave ethically. I mean, why couldn't Wells Fargo have designed a system that actually incentivized frontline employees to actually help customers become more financially healthy and then tried to measure how employees are actually helping those customers become financially healthy? I mean, that would be really what Wells Fargo's vision sets out to do.
Michael, we're almost having a break here, but the CEO said that opening up all these accounts deepened relationship with the customers. And that seemed to be one of his explanations, one of his responses to the criticism. About 30 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, it deepened it, deepened the resentment that would ultimately come from it. It defied common sense that you could, in this economy, there would be this much demand for banking services. I mean, people are just getting back on their feet, in terms of like getting their balance sheets and the foreclosure crisis. And this is this period that this was happening. The economy wasn't booming. So the idea that people would need all this banking accounts, it didn't make any sense. And that's clearly what turned out to be the reality.
Well, we're talking about the crisis, the scandal at Wells Fargo. That's Michael Corkery. He's been covering this for the New York Times. Also with us is Lynn Anderson, Associate Professor of Human Resources Management at the Fox School of Business at Temple University. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, Senator Elizabeth Warren is called the CEO of Wells Fargo Bank gutless, said he should be criminally investigated. We're talking about the problems at Wells Fargo Bank. Came to light about a month ago when it was learned that something like 5,000 employees at the bank were fired for secretly opening fake accounts in its customers' names. They describe a pressure cooker environment to meet sales quotas, and the CEO faced a barrage of criticism from Congress, and the bank faces further investigations. Talking with Michael Corkery, financial reporter for the New York Times, Lynn Anderson, a professor of Human Resources at Temple University, who specializes in corruption and corporate culture. 1-888-477-9499. That's the phone number to join our conversation. 1-888-477-9499. Michael, let me go back to you. And certainly, if an account is open in a customer's name and they do not know this, that's clearly a problem and probably some kind of a crime. How much were customers hurt? And I'm assuming we're talking about fees that they were not aware of. That, of course, mounts up. And if we're talking about close to 2 million accounts. Any way to know how much customers were actually hurt?
Well, the bank's analysis, upon which the regulators relied, showed that about $2.6 million in fees were charged to people that should not have been charged. Now, that in the grand scheme of things seems like not that much money, you know, when you see it's 2 million accounts. But I think it's not just, again, how much money they were charging, how much fees they were you know, had to pay that they shouldn't have. I mean, it's what was done. It was this violation of trust. I mean, these people were entrusting their most secure financial information with their bank, and they were using that information to create fake accounts to benefit themselves. I mean, it is, you know, it's a despite it not being a huge amount of money that was charged to folks, it's a huge violation, and I think that's what is so alarming about this.
And a number of those fired employees have said, well, we needed the money. They were being paid $12 to $15 an hour. I'm assuming that's probably $25,000 a year, something like that. They said they needed the money.
Right. And that's, I mean, again, I think that John Stumpf, when he first responded, when the bank sort of put its first foot forward in responding to this crisis, when it broke and the regulators announced the fine that the bank had to pay, I mean, he basically put it on them and said, oh, these folks, they were not following our culture and we had to get rid of them. And we have been getting rid of them. But, you know, it became clear that he was basically saying, you know, this is all on my lowest level employees who make $12 an hour. Like, it's their fault. I mean, he didn't sort of say it in such stark terms, but that's basically what it implied. And that made it much worse for him, because I think, you know, I mean, these are not easy jobs and they're not getting paid a lot. And these are folks, these are single moms. These are, you know, low income in some cases, trying to support families. I mean, and they're under these enormous pressure to meet unrealistic goals. And that just was not a good argument for John Stumpf to be making.
And Lynn, there were some whistleblowers that tried to shed light on what was happening at Wells Fargo. What happened to them?
Absolutely. Now more and more are sort of joining the fray and kind of coming out and saying, look, I tried to blow the whistle. I used our internal ethics hotline, or I spoke to my manager and I tried to, you know, tell them about the pressures that I was feeling to produce at this rate, this anxiety I was feeling. And what happened to a lot of them, and as I know Michael has reported on, a lot of them ended up like being fired or let go for other reasons. So now we've got this idea that there was like a retaliation against whistleblowers, which is a whole nother thing that's happening. And a lot of fired employees today and would-be whistleblowers are trying to seek remediation. You know, they're trying to get together and they're trying to pull together a class action suit against Wells Fargo for being wrongfully fired and wrongfully terminated.
I know you have to leave us in a couple of minutes, Michael. Let me get to Ryan from Yardley to join our conversation. And Ryan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey now, Marty. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm okay. Look, I wanted to bring up the fact that this practice is still ongoing, because I had a problem with fraud recently. Someone took my debit card number, but I had to make some changes to my accounts. Sometime after September 26th, these guys just did the same thing to me. They just created a phantom account that I never authorized and started deducting fees from it. So I'm wondering also if there's some kind of recourse I have, or if this is maybe in violation of some kind of consent decree or postal integrity agreement they now have, which I may have missed that earlier. I just turned it on. Sorry.
No, that's okay. Ryan, let me see what Michael Corkery has to say. Michael?
Well, I would. It certainly sounds plausible. I mean, I think since this story has broke, I have gotten many, many tips and calls and emails from people saying this has happened to them, both at Wells Fargo and at other banks. The CFPB, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is the main regulator on this, they keep a database of complaints. And their most recent sort of snapshot of that database shows a lot of complaints, like your callers saying from banks all across the industry, consumers writing in saying, I there's an account that I didn't sign up for, but I have. So this thing seems very widespread, this issue, much wider than Wells. My advice is, you know, I would call in or write in via email to the CFPB and lodge a formal complaint. I mean, they're on this issue. This is probably their top priority right now, is sort of rooting out these problems that were exposed at Wells across the banking industry.
Michael, it's hard not to think about what happened in 2008, the meltdown on Wall Street, the financial meltdown on Wall Street, and there were clearly some protections put into place. And, of course, this raises questions about how effective those protections have been. You mentioned the CFPB. Where do we stand, do you think?
Well, there has been a lot of regulation. And if you ask the bankers, they'll say there has been too much regulation put in place since 2008. I'd say two things. I mean, one, if there ever was, a case study that the Democrats and the Obama administration and Elizabeth Warren would make for the need for the CFPB, it's this. Yeah. It's what happened at Wells Fargo. I mean, there's been lots of debate in Congress. The Republicans sort of want to defund the CFPB. They've been after it. I think this cuts that argument short, because those same Republicans were up there, giving John Stumpf just as hard a time as the Democrats were this past week. So I would say that. And then I think also, if anything, this also shows that even with all that new regulation, these type of scandals can exist at a huge bank. And I think this revives the debate over whether banks are still too big. And I mean, this is, you know, Wells Fargo has 250,000 employees. John Stumpf and others at Wells Fargo have made the argument that over and over again that, hey, you know, yeah, 5,000 employees getting fired seems like a lot, but it's only 1% of the total bank. Right. But that means it's a really, really big bank, and probably too big by some measures, too big to manage, to keep an eye on all this stuff happening. And I think that's, in terms of the debate about whether it's reasonable to start breaking up these big banks, I think this scandal brings that back into focus.
Well, I assume you're going to be kept busy over the next couple of months covering this, Michael. Thanks. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Reporter for The New York Times, who covers finance and banking and has been covering the scandal at Wells Fargo Bank. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Lynn Anderson staying with us for the rest of the hour. Again, Associate Professor of Human Resources Management at the Fox School of Business at Temple University. And she specializes in corruption and corporate culture. Interesting, this whole, I mean, it does have this deja vu feeling. I don't want to go too much out on a limb here, but sure. One sort of senses this too big to manage, too big to fail. Are we kind of back in the soup again?
It really feels like we are. Although if you look at the big banks, they seem to be trying, right? I mean, J.P. Morgan and Goldman actually issued reports in the last couple years kind of illustrating how they do business and trying to explain, you know, their mistakes in the past and how they plan to improve. At the same time, that looks great. They're trying to change their corporate culture. But the truth is they're not getting rid of any of their risky business practices like proprietary trading and private equities. They're still doing all that, which still creates a culture of risk, anxiety, pressure. Arguably, Morgan Stanley's a little bit different. Their CEO, James Gorman, has really concertedly tried to change the culture. And he's actually de-emphasized proprietary trading and started emphasizing wealth management instead, which is arguably less risky. He's also cutting senior executives' pay and limiting bonuses. It's made some employees flee from there. But he's kind of saying, well, we need to make our culture less risky. You know, we don't want to be, you know, too big and too dangerous and you know, putting the whole economy at risk.
But when all is said and done, if someone is chairman and CEO of a bank, a corporation, a company, are they not ultimately responsible for everything that happens, even if they don't know anything about it?
Ultimately, they should be. But the way we have set up the corporate form and the liability that, you know, that accrues, you know, they ultimately aren't. And they've found ways and mechanisms to protect themselves and, again, push all the problems down to lower level employees. I mean, even when corporate fines are levied, the executives don't experience a loss. It's the shareholders that end up paying out of their pockets. So, you know, really we have this rise of corporate impunity, and the executives are kind of preserving themselves. And they're sort of an incestuous class, as you know. You know, there's a lot of interlocking directorates where one person sits on one board, is on the board of three other companies, and you know, it's still, I hate to say it, a good old boy club. You know, there's more women and minorities on boards today, and there's a few more women executives, but it's still, and you know, a kind of a messy, nepotistic good old boys club.
How hard is it to change a corporate culture?
It's so difficult.
I mean, it's hard to change a culture anyway. I mean, it's hard to change. People don't change behavior unless they absolutely have to.
Right, right. I mean, we've seen companies under crises, under duress, have to really change, and a lot of them can't do it. And ultimately, that might lead to their demise. Again, you know, it's really interesting to look at Gorman at Morgan Stanley and see what he's trying to do. But again, in order to change culture, he's having to actually change the practices of the company to change culture.
And incentives, yeah. And all that kind
exactly.
of thing.
Exactly.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with incentives, right? But they just have to be realistic.
Yeah, and they have to align with your vision and mission, you know, and your values, your company, or your espoused values, at least. They have to align with that. And we're just seeing again and again that it's like ethics is a sidebar thing. You push it to the side. You have a mission and then an ethical vision that's separate, and your ethical vision's not tied to your incentives. It's not tied to anything employees are doing. And the employees actually view it as a joke.
Oh, they do?
Sometimes, because they know they have to go through ethics training, and they might watch a silly video or something, and they end up kind of being really cynical about the whole ethics thing because they're seeing on the ground that ethics, the espoused ethics, aren't being enacted.
Let me get some more callers in. We've got, it looks like John calling us from Oaks. And John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi, Marty.
Hi.
Thanks
there.
For taking the call.
You're welcome.
To the point that the last person was making about, you know, ethics and mission statements. First, you know, mission statements is nothing more than marketing for large corporations to espouse a nice sounding goal or objective that's pleasing to the general public and investors. In reality, these practices, one of them I'm familiar with is called cross-selling. Cross-selling has a secondary objective, and that objective from a corporate standpoint is entanglement. And it is that you get the customer so deeply woven into your organization through all these different angles and connection points that it makes it impossible for the customer to back out of that relationship, even if the relationship is deleterious to the customer. It becomes overly complex and overly difficult to do competitive analysis with different companies who might be able to provide you a better service at a lower cost.
Well, you know, John,
it's entanglement.
Sure, yeah, no, I appreciate it. And we were talking at the beginning of the show about this cross-selling and Wells Fargo, but you added a really good illustration to what we've been talking about. Go ahead. Go ahead, Lynn.
John, I love the word entanglement. That is so appropriate. I'm going to use it from now on in my classes. You're so right. Customers can't extricate themselves anymore. They're just so entangled, and it's so hard to get out, and it's so much of a pain to, like, call and email and just, you know, go again and again to try to get yourself out of these accounts that you kind of give up. A lot of customers just resign.
Hmm.
And along those lines, with resignation comes a whole downstream set of problems for the customers, not only in fees, but in reduced credit ratings, reduced credit scores, because they don't know that they're so entangled.
John, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Picking up on what you just said there, and one wonders about the reputation. As you said, it's hard to extricate oneself from some of these banking institutions. But one wonders about the reputation of Wells Fargo, how much of a hit it's going to take. Its stock has tumbled.
Right. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, increasingly, you know, we as a society are becoming more cynical about big banks and big business in general. You know, I always say to my students, like, you know, 20 years ago or 25 years ago, when I first got into this business of teaching in business schools, it was sacrilege to sort of diss big corporations in the mainstream business media. Today, all this just keeps pouring out. Even the Wall Street Journal is reporting, you know, corporate crime and questioning capitalism even, right? We're even questioning it. So people are getting more cynical. I think that it has been conveyed somewhat in this election cycle, where we have a lot of a couple anti-establishment candidates sort of have come forth. People are disgruntled, And, you know, people are viewing this Wells Fargo event as just more of the same and maybe the ineffectiveness of Dodd-Frank and its impotency.
Well, and a kind of cynicism that you can't be a capitalistic institution and be ethical.
Absolutely.
But do you think it's possible to do both?
I do. I do. I'm actually, despite the fact that I'm so cynical myself, I'm actually hopeful. I feel like there's a lot of cool initiatives out there today that are kind of trying to remediate some of these problems. For instance, right here in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia area in Paoli, we have a group of people, a nonprofit called B-Lab that is that has really created a new corporate form called benefit corporations. A company can become a B Corp by passing a number of criteria, by being audited by the B-Lab folks, by taking a test and a survey and showing and conveying that they look out for all of their stakeholders versus just looking out for the needs of their stockholders, shareholders. But also they've created a new legal corporate form. I forget, it's like maybe in like 35 states now it's been passed, including Pennsylvania, that we have this new corporate form that if you were to incorporate, you know, tomorrow, Marty, as a company, you could incorporate as a B Corp versus a C Corp. And in doing so, you would pledge to look out for the needs of all of your stakeholders versus just your shareholders.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, that's Lynn Anderson, our guest for the rest of the hour, Associate Professor of Human Resources Management at the Fox School of Business. That's at Temple University here in Philadelphia. And we're talking about the recent behavior at the Wells Fargo Bank brought the question of ethics of big banks to the fore. The company put pressure on low-level staff to meet sales quota, resulted in the creation of actually millions of fake accounts in customers' names. CEO has been fined, had to answer some pretty stinging questions last week in Congress, and Senator Elizabeth Warren really hit him up the week before. 1-888-477-9499. A lot of people that want to join the conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Lynn Anderson and with you about what happened at Wells Fargo, the repercussions, what the repercussions will be for their actions and the ethics of big banking. And you can join the conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. There is another banking model, something called public banking. Explain that to us, Lynn.
Well, it's really interesting. You know, I'm no expert on it, but it's really been intriguing to talk about as an alternative to all these big banks. Interestingly, as you've probably heard, the California state treasurer, John Chang, he's also running for governor in California right now. He basically said, you know, the state of California is suspending business relations with Wells Fargo for a full year and maybe beyond. And so that led me to start thinking about, what could California do now? Are they just going to go reinvest, you know, pull our money in another big bank, or are they going to do something else? Well, there's actually a model for all this, and that is there's the 100-year-old Bank of North Dakota.
Wow.
It was created a century ago, and it's been held up lately as an alternative model for banking. And there's a woman, the author of a book called The Web of Debt and the Public Banking Solution, a woman named Ellen Brown, who about 6 years ago founded the Public Banking Institute to kind of explore what would a public bank look like? How would it look? And really, it's a bank that operates in the public interest. It can be at different levels. It could be at the municipal level, the state level, or even the national level. And what would happen is in such a bank is that the public would gain interest from the bank, and the money wouldn't go to, you know, privately owned banks and getting money for shareholders. Public banks are able to sort of reduce their taxes within their jurisdictions because all the profits are returned to the general fund of the public entity. So they're owned by the public, as opposed to, say, even a credit union that's owned by the members of the credit union.
So who runs it? Is it the government that runs it?
Well, interestingly, in some of the ways they've been run, the legislatures will pick and select a board and a CEO to run it. But they're supposed to be run free of influence from legislatures. And there's even talk about, say, having staggered terms of people on these boards so they wouldn't be tied to a specific term of a specific legislator. And interestingly, in Philadelphia, city council voted unanimously in January of this year to take the first step toward the creation of a public bank for the city of Philly. And it's going to be modeled on the Bank of North Dakota.
Well, let's get back to our call. It's something to think about. Let me see what Laurel from Haddonfield has to say. Hi, Laurel. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
To all this, and what strikes me is that the overall systemic problem is just not going to go away until the customers take action. I mean, I've been a moving target for TD Bank that one time saved a fee until 2 months later. So they waited. I had 7 checks, and then they put it in and the disaster. I'm a moving target. So I thought, listening to NPR, what can the public do as a response? And how about those accounts that were owned by those banks owned by minorities? We're talking about Black Lives Matter and what the African Americans can do to protest. And why not all of us, or many of us, support those banks? You don't have to be Black, I assume, or Hispanic.
Of course not.
To go and put your money in a bank like that. And then not only that, but you show some unity with the people in their businesses.
Well, Laurel, let me see what our guest Lynn Anderson has to say. I mean, you mentioned the idea of a public bank, but there are options, are there not?
Well, interestingly, public banks aren't places where individual customers or businesses can deposit. So they're not for that purpose. But as Laurel points out, why don't we put our money in credit unions, in local and community banks? But even there's a problem there in that the local and community banks keep being eaten up by the larger banks. I mean, all of us have that experience of like saying, I joined on with this bank, but now it was bought by this bank, and suddenly I'm, you know, 4 banks later, I'm with a different bank. But certainly that's one thing we can do, as Laurel pointed out, is put our money in different places. Mm. Try not to use these big banks. Credit unions for now are a viable alternative for us.
Laurel, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me read some comments and email from Scott. Have to wonder what is being taught at the university business level. $12 an hour to pay student loans and live and eat. The complex of academic and financial was clearly at the base of 2008. Has anything changed? Raising the question, of course, about the people who get a degree in banking or business.
Yeah.
And do they have the kind of ethics that we want?
Oh my God, that's like a question I could go on forever about. But
I figured.
Interestingly, after the whole Enron and WorldCom and AT&T debacles back at the turn of the century, business schools started really waking up. A lot of business MBA programs and undergraduate business programs have had an ethics course or something even before that. But after that, the accrediting body of business schools, which is AACSB, started demanding that ethics be taught in business schools, and either as a standalone course or incorporated to all of the courses. So, you know,
is that like the training at businesses where people roll their eyes? And
yeah. Yes. Interestingly enough, yes. And it's really interesting because the people that teach it come from a variety of different avenues, right? There's people like me who are social scientists who did PhD in social science. I did a PhD in business and society. And so I might teach it one way. There are lawyers who teach the classes in business schools who might teach it from a more legal framework. And then there are even philosophers sometimes in business schools who might teach it from a more theoretical, philosophical framework. So there's not one way of teaching it. Plus, like you said, it can seem sort of cynical just to have a class that says behave like this and you'll be good, you know. And in fact, at the Fox School, that's why we want to teach it in a way that forces students to look at the relationship between business and society, than really a how to be ethical at the individual level. Because how can individuals really be good in a system that may be bad and corrupt?
Let me read a couple more comments and we'll get back to our callers. A comment from Ryan. Customers need to be responsible, too. I always stay on at Wells Fargo. A tweet from Hugh. I suggest customers file a criminal complaint with attorney general in each state to prosecute employees. An email from Chuck. Carrie Tolstead, and she was the executive who oversaw Wells' community banking division for much of the past decade, seems to be spared from all this negative press. Why is she not before Congress, too? An excellent question. We touched on her, but we didn't go into any depth. You want to add add to that, and then we'll get back to
sure,
our callers.
Sure, absolutely. And I don't have a deep understanding of why she's been let off the hook, but here she is, the VP overseeing all the 100,000 employees who are in retail banking for Wells Fargo. 100,000 employees. Here she's the head of all that. She's been known as a really – the rap on her that I've gotten from the press is that she's a really dogged, detail-oriented employee, head down, do whatever the bosses say, and get things done. She's been wildly successful for them. But in some ways, is she sort of a pawn for all this? I don't know. Is she been – did she the one that orchestrated this kind of incentive system? You're led to believe from what I've read about her that no. And in fact, she's just sort of overseen it all but hasn't been the one that orchestrated it. And she's quietly now retiring to go back to her home state, I think, of Nebraska, you know, and just been sort of let off the hook.
Well, she lost some, I think, $19 million in compensation. I mean, some
she's
things.
She's still a rich woman.
Still happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And I asked this question earlier, but I mean, do you think, from what you know about corporate culture, that low level employees could think this stuff up and start opening fake accounts? Or do you think there was some kind of either direct directive or some kind of informal message that these employees got?
I think your latter thing is spot on, Marty. Informal message. I mean, I don't believe a company would directly ever put out anything. It wouldn't write down anything or put forth anything. They would say, you know, cheat and create some fraudulent accounts. But, you know, they certainly would wink and nod when they see it happening. Even though the espoused line is that over the last few years, managers have tried to come down hard on this, the pressures, the sales pressures, the incentives didn't change. So, you know, it seems like they were just sort of happy to have a subculture of supporting this.
Let me see what Michelle from, looks like Marlton has to say. And Michelle, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
And my question is for your guest.
Sure.
Lynn, I'm curious. When a CEO is incented by earnings per share, like the CEO of my corporation is, how does that influence sort of the decisions that they make? And also sort of the culture in an organization if strictly, you know, your compensation is based on earnings per share.
Oh, man, Michelle, that's perfect. That's like that one is so – that's another misaligned incentive system that exists, right? I mean, when CEOs and executives are trained basically – well, the messages from boards is that, you know, you're supposed to look out for the long-term interest of the company. But yet, you know, what they really care about is quarterly earnings. So – you know, of course they're going to do all sorts of things that just up the quarterly earnings and their own pocketbooks are, you know, amassed from just looking at quarterly earnings and putting in incentive systems that will, you know, increase those quarterly earnings. So that's one of the biggest overarching problems, Michelle. You're so right. That's like that is the one of the largest problems we have is the whole system in which corporations operate and that publicly held companies and their obsession with quarterly earnings.
Well, and I'm going back to Senator Warren, where she criticized the CEO of Wells Fargo saying, you benefited off this program.
Yeah.
And she quoted from his stock portfolio saying, look at what happened to you as a result of this program, I guess, within the bank. Michelle, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me read a couple of more comments. An email from Stoneharmer, same old, same old. After 2008, I thought the government was monitoring these sorts of things. Do Congress, government agencies also share responsibility? Do you think they do?
Yes, they do. But at the same time, look at the regulatory agencies, the enforcers of the banks, the SEC, the Department of Justice. They're all arguably underfunded. They're all arguably full of people who have also at other times operated defending the corporations. There's a huge revolving door. Matt Taibbi of the Rolling Stone has written about this just ad nauseum,
yes,
about the revolving door between the prosecutor regulators and the defenders of who work for the corporate defense law firms who defend these big banks. It's like a big party. He talks about actually going to a party where all these people are hobnobbing and having a great time. And, you know, you see it when people like Eric Holder, you know, after he's the Attorney General of the United States, he goes back and, you know, earns tons more at a corporate defense firm.
Let me read a comment from Nick. He says, what are the intended results of the congressional committee hearing? Was the Justice Department expected to do anything? And there are going to be several investigations.
Sure.
And what do you think? I mean, is it just Congress letting off steam or do you think something will happen as a result of these hearings?
Well, we'll have to see. You know, it's so difficult today because, you know, to prosecute individuals, you have to show a guilty mind, which is really, really difficult. And the regulators basically lack tools for prosecuting individuals. I mean, I think the Department of Justice in the Southern District, in, say in New York, Preet Bharara, who's been heralded as a dogged prosecutor, you know, they might try. But again, the regulatory agencies are weak, underfunded. They often even face like political harassment from the corporations and their lawyers, believe it or not. And there's a fear still after Enron and Arthur Andersen of collateral consequences.
What does that mean?
Meaning that, like, you know, when Enron went down, it took Arthur Andersen, the venerable accounting firm, down with it. And I think prosecutors are scared of that. That, you know, they don't want to kill off these organizations, right? And so there's fear of that too, which is keeping, you know.
Let me see what Garrett from looks like Exton has to say. And Garrett, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Very, very glad to be here.
Sure.
I am a 45-year veteran of Wall Street and the financial services industry. I've been there, done that. I was one of the people you're talking about.
Really?
I hold very senior positions. And I'm telling you, nothing is going to change until we start getting bad guys like Mr. Stump fitted for orange jumpsuits. They're not afraid of fines. It's just money.
Yeah.
It's like finding a plumber three pipe wrenches. That's just what they deal in.
You're saying fines are not enough?
Yeah.
Remember the SNL crisis in the early 80s?
Sure.
Mr. Keating went to jail. Have we had much trouble with the SNL industry?
Well, that's interesting. Garrett, let me give our guests a chance to respond.
Oh, man, Garrett, I want to have you come into my class. This is so great. I totally agree. I think these fines are a pittance, right? $185 million is nothing for Wells Fargo when they made $5.6 billion last in the second quarter of this year. I mean, that's like, you know, and again, the shareholders are the ones paying for it. I mean, I have to agree with Garrett that we've got to find ways. And there's been a couple people writing about that, writing about there was a woman, what's her, Steinmetz, I believe her name is, who's written a book talking about, I'm no lawyer, but all the legal avenues, that the creative legalese we might do to take down individuals in this climate where it's very difficult to prosecute individuals. But, you know, I think Garrett's right. It's the only way.
Garrett, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Something I was reading about Wells Fargo, and I think it's gotten buried in this coverage of these fake accounts. It was fined $20 million for a lending program to members of the military, basically doing a vehicle seizure programs if people were late on their repayments. So not to single out Wells Fargo, but this is all part of this larger story.
Sure. It's pervasive. I mean, it's not just Wells Fargo, and I think the Department of Justice realizes that. It's going to have to look into other banks for these practices as well.
I mean, do you figure it's if they're doing it at Wells Fargo, they're probably doing it somewhere else?
Yes.
You do?
Yes.
You just rolled your eyes at me.
Yes.
So are we going to be able to clean up our banking system?
You know, I don't know. Again, taking down individuals, the rise potentially of public banking, we'll see if it really takes off. There's a lot of skepticism around it. There's questions about whether municipalities can actually, you know, manage funds without any corruption or anything. You know, it's really hard not to be cynical about it.
Well, and I wonder what you'll be looking for about 30 seconds or so before we have to end our conversation. But as you, even with Wells Fargo, what will you be looking for? Is there something on the horizon?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll be watching and following this to see if this changes overall how they set up systems in place. I mean, deep-rooted systems from the top that sort of, you know, address this misprioritization of their stakeholders. Really, let's see now if they can align their customer service vision with actually caring about customers. It seems difficult as long as we have banks allowed to, you know, at post-Glass-Steagall, allowed to gamble with money and, you know, keep up these proprietary trading practices.
Well, Lynn Anderson, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Associate Professor of Human Resources Management at the Fox School of Business at Temple University. And we began our conversation with Michael Corkery, a reporter for The New York Times who covers finance and banking. Clearly a lot of interest in this topic. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about the program. Download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thanks for joining us.